Dave's psychology lectures are part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network. Okay, before we get going today, you may notice then, let's see here, move this out of the way. If you go, do I have a signal in here? Yeah, I do. Okay. If you go to my website there, peopletodayuc.ca/Broadbeck, if you click on, you can get the lectures themselves here, of course, the PowerPoints, and there's about 7 or 8 of them already posted. You can also go there on a good day. It should work. It does work. There's something funny going on in here. But anyway, when you do, let's get that again. Okay. Quit Safari. Go back in. Anyway, I am so connected to the internet, you peacer. Anyway, when you click on that blog link, it'll take you to a page that has all my classes on it. You can also then download the individual lectures. You can subscribe. There's a little button you can click that says iTunes, and then it'll, if you have iTunes, it'll just download each lecture directly there. You'll get all my classes that way. You can't get enough, you know. So even though you're not in the other two classes, perhaps you get those. So that'll be there, and so you'll be able to get that pretty easily if you check that out. Which is why I'm recording, as you can see with the little mic here, the audio. So today, we're going to introduce this stuff. I'm going to introduce this stuff to you guys. Basically, some background, a little history, some definitions, sort of get us going, because this material gets horribly dense. Okay? So, you know, you got neuroanatomy, neurophysiology. This is not the easiest stuff in the world because a lot of it's memory work. Okay, it's not like you can... The concepts aren't so bad, but the names of stuff isn't the easiest thing in the world. So we'll start a little slowly, and I'll give you some background into how stuff works, and we'll go from there. Well, that all came up at once. Well, such is life. So we're going to talk about history and the origins of the study of brain and behavior. The course is supposed to be about the relationship between brain and behavior. That's why it's called brain and behavior. The question that many people, philosophers, physicians, psychologists, neuroscientists, this is a question that people have been asking for a very long time. What is the relationship between brain and behavior? It's funny, I think on the surface, most of us in this room, how many people here are not psych majors? A few of you. Okay, how many of you are biology majors that aren't psych majors? Okay. Most of us, probably psych majors or not, would certainly accept, if I said to you, behavior comes from your nervous system, you'd say, yep. And then if I asked you the question, is there something different between your mind and your body, most of the data, well, I'll ask you that question. Is the mind part of the body or is it something separate? Who thinks the mind's part of the body? Okay, who thinks it's separate? All right. A lot of people, typically, the average person says that the mind and the body are two separate things. Now, it's funny because if we accept that behavior comes from the nervous system, comes from the brain, comes from the spinal column, and, you know, et cetera, you're actually saying that your behavior comes from your nervous system. Yet, the majority of people out there will tell you that they think that the mind and the body are two separate things. These are irreconcilable positions, aren't they? They really are. Is seeing, let's think of an example here. So, is seeing separate from the body? I don't think so. You use your eyes and it gets interpreted by your brain and you see. It doesn't seem separate to me. And most of us would accept that. You got the gear and the inputs come in and there's the world. However, how is that different than your mind and your body? Your mind, you think, well, that's internal mental life. Well, so seeing. There's stuff out there we can't see that really is there. Infrared, ultraviolet. Right? There is energy we don't convert into neural energy. We don't have the gear to detect it with our physiological gear and our anatomy. We certainly have it. We can buy a little meter that can do that. That's easy. But with what we're built with. Yeah. So it's interesting that most people actually believe surveys show this over and over again. Scientists will tell you that there's no difference, but the average person says that there is. So that's that's where it is, sort of a philosophical question. Physicians, so your MDs, fake doctors. I wrote a thesis. I'm a real doctor. Are certainly interested in this because, of course, they've got the sort of hands-on. You got somebody with a head injury and something suddenly missing. It could be anything from your ability to transfer things from short to long-term memory, the classic case of HM. It could to something as strange as when an object moves, it disappears. When it's still, it's there. When it moves, it disappears. This can happen from a very specific lesion. This would be less likely from an accident like a bump on the head. It'd be more likely to be from a stroke. Or you lose the ability to say anything, to speak, even to write, to produce language, yet you can understand language. More strangely, you lose the ability to understand language, yet you can still produce it. You can say things, but you don't know what you mean. Whoa. That's a glitch in the matrix right there. That's pretty weird. But of course, it's going to interest them. Psychologists are going to be interested because, we study behavior and cognition. And if that's what we're studying, we got to find out where it comes from. And if it comes from the nervous system. So the relationship between the nervous system itself and behavior and thinking, cognition, is clearly a question for psychologists. And neuroscientists, on the other hand, are going to be more interested in and I'm making sweeping generalizations here, by the way. Neuroscientists are going to be more interested in how cells communicate, perhaps. How different regions of the brain communicate with each other. However, there is a field that's become quite mature now called behavioral neuroscience, which is really the melding of psychology and neuroscience. And a lot of behavioral neuroscientists are in psychology departments. So they basically study the interaction and the relationship between behavior and brain. Right? And we can go with, there's probably a whole bunch of other people that are interested too. But I can't think of any others. I got a bunch that started with P and then went with N, and that's pretty much all I had. We got to define a couple of terms, brain and behavior. And then we can look at how these different groups of people have looked at this relationship. And we'll talk a little bit about some philosophers, some MDs, some psychologists, and some neuroscientists. In the next couple of days and how they have talked about this. So we'll talk a little bit about some of the history as well. And the history is an important thing. A lot of people wonder why you'd want to know about the history of a field if you're... I mean, this is a very current thing and it's constantly changing. I was making that point in the Hello, My Name is Dave lecture that this field is constantly changing. But we really do have to know about the history of a field, I think, no matter what the field is. It gives us... perspective. right? Where we came from. So we had to define brain and behavior. You're thinking, well, that's kind of crazy. Like, I know what those both mean, but let's, you know, it's going to kill some time. So what's a brain? And of course, is the brain from Pinky and the Brain. Well, it's something you can kick. It's a piece of tissue. My friend Rob used to always say, if you can't kick it, it ain't real. In other words, if it's not a physical thing, it's not a real thing. But then I know what Rob really meant was if you can't physically touch it, but also, or if you can't measure it, it's not something that science is interested in. Okay? So it's a real thing, though. It's a, you know, the actual organ itself, the tissue, the wrinkly bits in the head. That sounds somehow very British, doesn't it? It's the wrinkly bits in the head. You've got wrinkly bits in your head. Good thing that you do. It's an or an organ, you know, whatever the hell that means. So there's the actual physical thing itself. So is it the wrinkly bits? Yeah, well, technically, yeah, it really is. You know, probably if you looked it up in a dictionary, which is probably pretty much the worst place to ever look for a scientific definition of anything, is a dictionary. Dictionaries blow for things like this. For anything technical, look up the word ale in the dictionary. Usually not a very good definition. I'm a bit of a beer geek. Really, I'm just an alcoholic. But I remember talking about that with someone, and they had a definition of what an ale was versus a beer. And I said, an ale's a kind of beer.
That's not what it says here.
That's wrong. So, you know, technical terms, sometimes dictionaries aren't great. But yeah, technically, sure. I mean, we can talk about the wrinkly bits in your head. Then again, there are certain behaviors you can't do without, say, a spinal column, like, oh, I don't know, how about walk? Yeah, okay, so you kind of need that too. So that's going to be of interest to us as well, is your spinal column. So in this course, when we talk about brain and behavior, we're not just going to talk about the wrinkly bits in your head. We'll spend a lot of time on that. But we're also going to talk about the rest of the nervous system. So, like I said, there's a lot of behaviors you just can't do without a spinal column. Walking is a great example. That's a quote from the Star Trek episode, Spock's Brain. Brain, brain, brain. You use words that I do not understand. You are not Morg, you are not iMorg. The worst episode ever of Star Trek, even including every episode of Voyager. It's just a touch worse than all those. Worst Star Trek series ever. Did anybody actually like Voyager? No? I don't know. Never got into it. I watched it for 7 years. I'm a geek. You have to watch it. But I didn't like it. So, well, definition of brain really means just the thing in the head, the one you look up in the dictionary. Well, we'll have to concentrate not only on the brain, but the cerebellum back here, spinal column, and indeed other parts of the nervous system, too, if we want to relate them to brain and behavior. Because, I mean, still, even if you just talk about brain, cerebellum, spinal column, you still got the nerves that are making me move here. Yeah. You still get that as well. So you got all that stuff you have to talk about, not just the wrinkly bits in your head, right? Because something is making these muscles contract to allow me to walk around so much. So we have to talk about those two. It's almost better, it'd be better if we just called this course Nervous System and Behavior, or Introduction to Neuroscience. But, you know, it would take a lot of effort to change it, really smack of effort, and I don't feel like doing that. The committees it would go through, it would have to go through our Senate, the Laurentian Senate, and some dork in Sudbury would say no. Anyway. So we have to, if we're going to relate brain to behavior, we're going to have to talk about the rest of the nervous system as well. Okay? We just pretty much have to. Any questions so far? All right. So now we got where I introduced the whole topic today. I talked about the basically what's called the mind-body problem. Relating the mind to the body. Where does the mind end and the body begin? And this is the problem people that believe the mind is separate from the body have. When you ask them, when they say the mind is separate from the body, which, believe me, if you believe this, you have a long philosophical tradition behind you. You're wrong, but you have a long philosophical tradition behind you. You're also going along with what everybody else in society roughly is saying. You're still wrong, but you're this really, Rene Descartes, him, you know. I can say you're wrong all I want, but as I said this morning in evolutionary psychology, nobody's ever going to remember me. People will be talking about Rene Descartes in his fluffy shirt and stuff like that for years. I'm just assuming he wore a fluffy shirt. That was the style at the time. You know, if he was big in the 70s, he would have had a mullet, or the early 80s. You know, he was very stylish. So it's the mind-body problem. We're going to try to relate the mind to the body. That's what we're doing here. The body doing the behaving, the mind doing the cognition. But then where is this? You know, my funny bone. I always forget the name of it. Really, it gives you a lot of, you know, confidence in me too that I can't remember what the name of this bundle of nerves is. But okay, so those are neurons. There's a whole big crap load of them. Trying not to swear too much for the whole interweb thing, you know. So you got that big bundle of nerves right there, don't you? Yeah, we all know that. So I'm going to push it, and watch. I'm going to behave. Here, I'm going to behave again. Come on. Oh, there it goes. That was behavior. It's pretty simple behavior, but it was behavior. That's neural tissue, neurons, whole big, just a lot of them. Is that mind? Is this little bit by my elbow, is that part of my mind? I don't know. We'd all say it's part of my body. But is it part of my mind? I guess. I've never thought of that before. I honestly have never thought of that before until like 10 seconds ago when I started doing this thing. But it's sort of a decent example. If I do say so myself, there's a reason they underpay me for this job. I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, if we think that the mind's separate from the body and the mind's made up of neurons and those are then that's my mind, but it's also my body. It's kind of a weird, that whole duality thing. It's a little complicated to me. I don't like complicated. I like easy. I'm a scientist. I like simple. Simple explanation is the best. Let's talk about a little bit about the nervous system then. Okay. We're going to divide this up, and there's a few ways you can divide the nervous system up, okay? This is one that you're probably used to, which is the central nervous system, which is the brain, the spinal column, and the cerebellum. The cerebellum is at the back of the brain. I should have brought the brain model in. I'll try to bring it often enough. It's like that's Latin for little brain, actually. It really is, too. I took Latin, high school, for 4 years. And the spinal column. So brain, spinal column, cerebellum, that is the central nervous system. The communication here is neural. What do I mean by that? I mean that it's neurotransmitters, it's action potentials. These are all terms you're familiar with from intro. And don't worry, we'll talk a lot about them. But the communication here is neural. So it's neurotransmitters, it's action potentials, resting potentials, inhibition, disinhibition, electrical to chemical, over and over and over again. So that is the CNS, or the central nervous system. As soon as it leaves your spinal column, we're talking about the peripheral nervous system. The communication here is neural as well. Most of these neurons are what are called interneurons. Most of the neurons that you have in your body are interneurons. They're just going from one place to another. Then you have what are called, to make you move, you have a motor neuron, and it synapses on a muscle. It attaches to a muscle. It releases a neurotransmitter onto that muscle, and the muscle contracts. So chemical, electrical, finally chemical, neurotransmitter onto muscle, muscle contracts. The communication here is neural as well. And I mean, this is that bundle of nerves that, whose name I never remember, my funny bone. Funnius is, that's part of my peripheral nervous system, and the communication here is neural. That's the whole bunch of neurons. Okay? So really, sometimes people say that's an artificial distinction, and it is to a point. And there's another way we can look at it, and we'll talk about that later on as well. This is a perfectly good way to look at the nervous system. Okay, it's not like this is wrong. I'm not doing one of those things like I do when I teach statistics, and I go through this great big long thing about the, what is it called? The MAD, the something mean absolute deviation. Everybody's calculating it, and then after half an hour, I say, yeah, but that's useless. Now this is useful. This is useful. The communication here is neural as well. So really, the kind of communication is the same as in the central nervous system, and so is what's being used, which is neurons. Nope. Yeah, let's talk about how those two go together first. And now we're going to go through some stuff that if you've had me teach you before, you've heard before, because if it's been anything except for those of you that I taught 1107, or that if I've only ever taught you statistics, you've heard my favorite things in the world, my all-time favorite science things, so some of you guys can go to sleep. Let's talk about something simple. You got a bicep curl. Look at that, it's like Schwarzenegger. The muscle is what's called an agonist. That's something to get it going, and an antagonist, something to make it stop. A motor neuron, well, first of all, I'm going to curl my right bicep, so somewhere up around, here, a message is sent out down through my spinal column, and my muscle, my bicep curls up. But there's going to have to be a lot of messages, because it's not like one neuron makes my bicep curl up. There'd be a bazillion of them. Quite a few. And then it stops, like, oh, I can't go any further, and it's a stop. And then I can let it go as well. The whole time, I'm getting to my brain, or from my brain, down through my spinal column, out to my bicep, telling the bicep to curl up. And that at the same time, I'm constantly getting feedback from what are called sensory neurons in my bicep that are detecting where my arm is, that are detecting how far my muscle is contracted, and they're sending messages back through my spinal column up to my brain saying, okay, it's there, it's there, it's there. The amazing thing is this isn't happening at the speed of light. It's not happening at like the speed of electricity. It's way slower than that, which is really kind of weird because it's like it seems to happen instantaneously. But there is a lag. This takes a lot of neurons. Like a lot. It's not like there's just one neuron that just tells my bicep to curl up. There's going to be millions of them. Millions. And then going through my brain, probably tens of millions of neurons. I don't know the exact number, even within an order of magnitude, but I'm sure it's millions. I'm pretty sure it's probably millions. Okay? So it's pretty simple. That's simple behavior, isn't it? Very simple behavior. It's, in fact, almost uninteresting behavior. Right. Questions so far? Okay. Next. So that's a very simple behavior taking a great deal of neurons in an in the most cognitively complex animal on the planet, us. That's pretty good. Now, on the other hand, and this is where those of you that have had me before for anything beyond 1107 can sleep. That's a nuctoid moth. Lousy, there's a lousy signal to that box. I should get that fixed. It looks great on my screen up here. Okay, this moth has two ears. One on this side of its thorax and one over here. Okay? Where are they going to put them? In their head? Little tiny, yeah, put them somewhere. And it has basically two sensory neurons, A1 and A2. I'm going to guess A's for audition. I really don't know, but I'm not going to guess that. Okay, so it's got two neurons. It's got the two-neuron ear. All right, there's a little drawing. I'm never going to have you reproduce this drawing of the moth ear. Okay? Promise. There's the bonus question. Okay, look. Air sac, air sac, air sac, air sacs. That's not that much like our ear because we don't have air sacs. However, we do have a tympanum. We have a membrane, right? A like an eardrum, basically. This is a moth eardrum. That's all that is. So, this vibrates, okay? And it makes these neurons fire. It's really, you know, at a very basic level, the same way your ear works. Now, we're missing some other stuff. There's no stirrup, anvil, and hammer, and they have real Latin names that I can never remember. And there's no semicircular canals. There's no hair cells. There's all kinds of other interesting stuff in the human ear, or any sort of mammalian ear. Doesn't matter. They skip some steps, the moths. They just got this thing. It vibrates, and it sends out signals to A1 and A2. Right? Now, of course, the same way that me touching that my funny bone, I love doing that for some reason, that's kind of weird, can make my finger move, a neuron can be made to fire through pressure. Right? Okay, so that's sort of what's going on here. They're not frequency sensitive. So unlike our ears are frequency sensitive, right? We can hear, well, we can determine different frequencies, different pitches. Right, so my voice sounds different than a girly voice. Especially considering I've got a bit of a cold. And I've got like a radio voice right now. All right. Their ears don't do that. They can't tell the difference. See, there's a big predator for the moth. Bats. Yeah, bats. So the bats are after the moths. Pretty cool. Funny though, the moths don't have a superhero. The bats got Batman. You don't hear about Mothman now, do you? Got a secret idea. He just flaps around and goes towards light. It's not very useful. It's easy to foil. The penguin just puts up a light, and the Mothman goes towards it. You know, I thought I had a whole bit there. I got nothing clearly. So they're not going to be frequency sensitive, but they're sensitive only to very high frequencies. Bats detect where other animals are. How do they detect where how their world works? They send out pulses of ultrasound, don't they? Right, they use sonar. Just like in the submarine movies. Right, ping. Give me one ping, Yuri. One ping only. Hunt for Red October, it's like my favorite movie. I know all the dialogue to that movie, which is another indication that I'm a bit of a loser. Are there any sonar contacts, Mr. Kamenov? Everybody should watch that movie and just dedicate their lives to it, because Sean Connery is so cool. How many other Scottish guys could play a Latvian in the Russian Navy with a Scottish accent and you believe it? You know? All right, so here's... bees. Bats. Some animal that starts with a B. So bats are sending out this ultrasound, and the rate at which the sound bounces back to their ears, they can paint a picture probably as detailed as we can see with sound, okay? It's pretty cool. And they fly around at night. Yeah. So the moth should be pretty sensitive to right around the frequency where the bats are sending out ultrasound. And that's well, they can't detect different bats. So the moth couldn't be flying around going, "That's Steve the bat. He's no good at hunting. I'm not concerned." They can't tell individuals because they can't tell different frequencies. But they can tell, "That's a bat, man." Not, "That's Batman," which would be entirely different. So they're sending out these signals. The moth should be sensitive to it. Here's the little neural network. It's really pretty simple. You got an ear and a wing muscle. The ear is hooked up to the muscle. It's really that simple. See, this ear is really, unlike our ears, which are, you know, so we can hear everything going around us within a certain frequency range, these ears are basically, you know, they're sensors to detect when the enemy is coming. The hunter is coming. And then the little Captain Kirk inside here says, "Red alert, Mr. Spock. Sensors indicate a bat is coming." It's not a good Shatner, but that's basically what I'm trying to show you there. Now, here we have, this is single cell recording. This is so neat. You take this neuron and you place a micro electrode across the neuron. These are not big, by the way. It's not like it's this big. You go, "Yeah, just put a VU meter on it." No, it's a little tiny thing. Little tiny electrode goes across it. Every time you get a little click here, it used to, in fact, be that you would actually hear an audible click with the older gear. Nowadays, we would just use a computer and it would actually give us a graph like this. That's when the cell fires. Let's look at the A1 receptor first off. So you get a stimulus, that's the sound, okay, comes on. And this is low intensity. That's not very loud. Intensity is loudness. This is not intense. This is! Okay. Quieter sound, a little bit of firing. There's also, you see some firing when it's not, when there's no, no sound. That's just random firing. It does happen. Right? Here, a little louder, moderate intensity, a little more firing. Neural activity here, high intensity sound, lots of firing. Look at this. This is kind of cool. The louder it is, the more the cell fires. What's that cell doing? It's encoding loudness. A single cell's doing this. It's encoding loudness. Working under the assumption that bats emit ultrasound at the same loudness all the time, which makes some sense, what is this actually encoding? How close the bat is, exactly. The louder the sound is, the closer the bat is. That one neuron, is encoding distance. Now, I'm not saying there's a little homunculus, little man, a little ghost in the machine, inside the bat saying, "Oh, it's getting closer." But the neuron itself is actually encoding distance. That's the A1. Look at the A2. Doesn't seem sensitive to sound, oh, except if it's really loud. If it's really loud, the A2 fires. All right. So that's like, what's that doing? That's like, back to your submarine movies, that's like a sound collision. Oh, something's really getting close, it's going to get me. All right. Questions so far? Does this make sense so far, what this neuron is doing? Yeah. These are moths. Well, they're moth neurons. Yeah. The bat is sending out the signal, the bat signal, and the moth's neuron is detecting, the A1 neuron is detecting how far away the bat is. Detecting, we're not detecting, it's encoding how far away it is, I would say is a better way to put it. Really. Based solely on intensity, yeah. So again, this is based on the moth's nervous system making the assumption that the bat would be sending out signals at the same intensity. But that really makes quite a bit of sense, because the bat's got to know how loud something comes back as well. So I mean, it does make some evolutionary sense that it would do this, that the predator, in this case the bat, would be sending them out roughly at the same intensity. Other questions? All right. Be careful, don't trip on wires. Okay. This is interesting here, that remember we have this random firing? It seems to go away with the A1 when you have pulses of sound versus a constant sound. Look what happens when it's a constant sound. The firing goes away. When it's pulses of sound, you get more firing. Well, guess what bats do? They send out pulses of sound. Evolution is so cool. It's an arms race, man. Because see, bats aren't going up to the moths going, they're sending out pulses. So if that happens, the moth's like, let's not, it's bat, it's some idiot. I'm kind of noob. Okay, so to go through this again, A1 is responsive to intensity. We can see that from the first column, the left column, I'm sorry, at the top of the diagram. More firing with a closer bat, that's all that means. A2 only fires with very loud sounds. A2 fires, but the bat must be very close. A2 will only fire if the bat is very, very close. Right? So that's basically what we're just talking about. There's maybe one more. It looks like there should be one more point there. Nope, sorry. Okay, so that's really just a summary of what I've been saying. Okay, again, A1's responsive to intensity, and it's encoding distance in essence. So it's going to be more firing with a closer bat. A2 only fires with very loud sounds, and A2 fires, but if A2 does fire, the bat must be really close, like right beside you. Okay? That's got to be really close for A2 to fire. And it's not, it doesn't matter how loud, once it's loud enough, it just keeps firing. That's what A2 does. Any questions up to now? Okay. All right. Somebody's got that. I can go to the next slide now. There we go. Okay. These charts, these pictures here, or this picture rather. If A1 on the left, so this is here, fires, what's that make happen? It makes that wing beat faster. So the moth will pretend, so I'm the moth, will pretend like, so you're the bat. So you're, please don't emit pulses of ultrasound. So she's the bat, I'm the moth, I'm just going along, and sound hits my ears. I start flapping my wings. But I'm on a bit of an angle here. One wing's going to beat faster than the other. It's going to turn me until I'm 180 degrees away and flying away, because it's hooked up to that wing. The moth then corrects its course to 180 degrees relative to the bat. If you don't think that's cool, you have no idea what cool is. Because that is a moth with a two-neuron ear doing vector mathematics. It knows. Now, I say knows, the nervous system is representing. I don't think the moth knows like we would know. But the moth is representing. It knows the distance and direction. Because with the two ears, it gets direction. Distance with the how far away, how intense the sound is. Distance and direction, and then plots a course away. That is vector math. I failed a test on vectors in grade 13 algebra. It's too bad I'm not a moth. Now, there's not a whole lot else they can do. So it's probably good I'm a human. It'd be kind of creepy if a giant moth was up here teaching you, right? Yeah. Just be constantly flying away when anything happened. Okay, what happens with A2? A2 is basically, it's really close. You know the story, or maybe you've even seen this. You cut a chicken's head off, the chicken still runs around. And all the guys know this because we did this as kids. I don't mean cut heads off chickens, but we took a daddy long leg and removed one of the legs and watched it move. Because that's what little boys do. We also take magnifying glasses and attack ants, watch them burn. That's what the boys do. Like all the guys or girls are like, the guys are like, yeah, I did that yesterday. The neurons in the daddy long leg legs are still firing, and it moves. A lot of what a nervous system is doing, a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of what it's doing is inhibition. It's stopping you from doing certain things. Okay? Sometimes it stops us from doing very complicated things. Right? So you walk into a bar, and someone bumps into you, you don't hit the guy. Because part of your nervous system's going, pushing that away. You have enough drinks, you inhibit your inhibition, and you get, what's your problem? And you hit the guy. And you spend a night in jail. That's not a personal experience. So what A2 does is it just says, turn off the inhibition. So it's just flapping around like crazy, hoping to, like, last second evasive maneuvers. Hoping. And again, I don't think they do a lot of hoping, the moths. But the nervous system is basically, that cool A1 vector math thing, that's pretty cool, but this is a good bat. It just turns off that inhibition. Moth sort of goes nuts for a while. Until, of course, it's not close anymore, or until it's become part of the all-you-can-eat moth buffet. So a two-neuron ear encodes where a predator is in three-dimensional space. Now, in essence, what we have here isn't really a central nervous system and peripheral nervous system thing. What we have here is just a simple circuit, a very simple circuit, in what I guess we'd probably call, I'm not an expert on the nervous system of insects, but I think we'd probably say that this was all peripheral if we were related to humans. It's not going into a brain and back. Invertebrates are kind of weird, so that way. But they're good eating. You know, lobsters, right? Shrimps, they're invertebrates. I like them. Questions about that? Now, what do we have here? We had a very simple behavior, moving your arm, that took, I don't know, a couple million neurons. We have really what looks like cognitively complex behavior here. That took a couple of neurons. This looks really, 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 really cognitive, right? Because the animal is representing a three-dimensional space where something is and then plotting a course away from it. Until naval vessels had computers that would do these things for them, you had a guy sitting there going, what the hell should we do? Well, and that's the captain, right? And then he'd say, plot a course that way, full speed ahead. And now, of course, computers take care of a lot of that stuff. Moths are like, yeah, I can do that myself. I can't do anything else. I don't have a navy. So part of the take-home message from this little bit about how this stuff interacts is that, and you want to keep this in mind, just because something looks complicated and cognitive, it needn't be. It might be horribly simple and involve very few neurons. It's a very simple circuit. And just because something looks horribly simple, right, flexing your arm, it might, in fact, involve a lot of neurons. Excuse me. So it may be the case. So looking at the behavior itself doesn't always tell you how complicated the neural circuitry is. It certainly, I've probably taken the two simplest, the two extreme examples here, but I think I can say that, you know, typically it's probably the case that something is cognitive, uses a lot of neurons, but that looked cognitive, and I don't know we'd call that thinking. I don't think we'd call that thinking. All right. Then there's the, yeah, go ahead. What would I call it if I didn't call it cognitive? I'd call that, I don't like the word instinct very much, but that's a whole theoretical thing I've got going there. I'd call that a stimulus causing a response. Yeah, I wouldn't go a whole lot further than that. I would say that it is representing vector mathematics, because that is what it's doing. But I wouldn't say that it was doing the math, let's put it. I would say the nervous system was doing it, though. Unlike, say, if I gave you the problem, you could sit there and use a couple hundred million neurons and figure it out. Right? Well, it wouldn't be that bad. Which way should you go? Away. You know, it wouldn't be that bad. But I think we have something a little bit different here. I think we've got, I mean, we wouldn't call it cognition. I don't know what instincts, as good a word as any. I mean, that's the one that people would probably typically use. Yeah. But it's the same way that, for example, a moth goes towards light. Phototaxis in that case, right? It just flies towards light. And the function of that, the light, it detects light and it keeps going until it's brighter and brighter and brighter. And the function of that is because that's where moths hang out, and they do that because so boy moths can meet girl moths, right? No, it's not the same as, it's, yeah, because I mean, still, that's all involving a whole, you know, bunch of neurons that's grabbing your funny bone. Yeah, you know, it's not that far off now when you think about it, because there's a stimulus and we're getting a response. So that's probably a better analogy than a lot of others. Yeah. Nice. Thanks. All right, then there's the autonomic nervous system. The communication in the central, it's different here in the autonomic nervous system than it is in the central and the peripheral nervous systems. Here, it's sort of a chemical thing. It's not neural. It's hormonal. A lot of times, neurotransmitters, and we'll talk all about neurotransmitters. A lot of times, neurotransmitters are, when they get into the bloodstream, can act as hormones. Hormones are secreted into the bloodstream by what are called ductless glands, various different glands. The master gland is the pituitary, and it basically sends messages to other glands saying, do this. Release this hormone. Release the hounds. And it releases them, and it changes your behavior. By the way, before I talk about this example, we can divide this up into two separate subsystems, the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system is the fight-or-flight response. That's the run away, or kick some ass. That's what that is, right? So you got a threat, and it's for fighting or running away, fight or flight. Heart beats faster, pupils dilate, et cetera, et cetera. So you can run away or you can fight. Parasympathetic's the opposite. It's like, just relax, man. Hang out. Digest your food. Fix your wounds, fight off infection. When one's going, the other one can't be going, and one takes basically energy from the other. So when you've got, when you're in the fight or flight response, suddenly you're not worrying about your gut anymore. If you've ever been in one of these situations too, when you're, even something as simple as when you're at a movie, like a scary kind of movie, you know, which I don't understand why people attend, because I don't get the entertainment value of being frightened. But others do. These are the same people that go on roller coasters. Anyway, suddenly after the movie, if it's a good suspense movie or something, you know, you're suddenly hungry. You weren't during the movie because your sympathetic nervous system's all kicked in, right? The last movie like that I saw was like Aliens, like 1986. Yeah, that'd probably be it. And then after the movie, you come out, and all your heart's been beating, and you go, and all worried. How can they cut the freaking power, man? They're animals. That's a great movie. Come out after that, it's like, wow, I could use three pizzas. Because your sympathetic nervous system's been using up all your energy. Now you're parasympathetic. Now that relaxes, parasympathetic kicks in. It's like, where you been, man? I've been hungry for a while, but I couldn't tell you because you were busy watching that movie, you idiot. So it's sympathetic, parasympathetic are these subsystems. So we get the release of two hormones that start labor. And you might be saying, well, that's not behavior unless you've had children or watched someone have children. Then you know that it certainly is behavior. It's interesting. We don't know how that starts. We know we can give to induce labor, drip those hormones, and you get really intense contractions. But, you know, you're thinking, well, that maybe that's not that. And this is no offense at anyone here that's had a child. But it's not that interesting, that behavior. It's pretty cool when you see it, though, because you look down and go, look, I made people. I don't need to make friends anymore. I can make new people. Not really, it's blow away. You've got kids, and now and then, even when they're older, like a 13-year-old daughter, and I look over and go, oh, man, I sort of made that in my own way. 45 seconds of light work, but nonetheless. You're thinking that's not really cognitive. And the women in here that have had children would realize that it's not like you have a lot of control over it. It's not like you think, oh, come on, hurry up. I think women think that, but I don't think it helps. I know a lot of women that have been like 8.5 months pregnant walking around going, whoosh, this thing would just be born. But that doesn't make the baby happen. Right? On the other hand, let's think about spatial ability. There's a male-female difference in spatial ability. It's small, but it's there. On average. Okay, so I can't pick a guy out of the room and a girl out of the room and say the guy's going to be a superior in spatial ability. However, if I had a room with equal numbers of men and women, which never happens in psychology, guys are all like, yeah, I know. I could probably get you to do something like a nice spatially loaded task, and the men would be better than the women. Now, there are tasks that we could find the women are better than the men, too. But I'm a guy, and I'm going to talk about how boys are better than girls. So, and let's think of something. Oh, how about throwing a ball at a target? You're going to say, come on, Dave, that's sports. Guys play more sports. How about throwing a ball at a target wearing prisms that make the world off by 45 degrees underhand using a Nerf ball? I don't think any of us have experience with that. So I'm going to put prisms on you. World's going to shift over 45 degrees. You're going to take a Nerf ball. You know, Nerf ball is like a foam rubber ball. And you're going to toss it at a target. And it's a Velcro target, so I can see how close you are. A friend used to do this kind of work. This is not easy, unless you're a guy. Actually, on average, men are much better at this than women. Just turns out that way. Unless you give the women a shot of testosterone, then suddenly they can get around the same as a guy. And in fact, women's behavior on this, performance on this, also depends on where they are in their menstrual period because of the hormonal environment. Wow, neat, eh? That's pretty complicated behavior. Now, please, I don't want someone saying, well, it's not my fault that we got lost. I'm having my period. Okay? And on the other hand, guys, I don't want you saying, no, you can't drive. You're having your period. I'm driving. Okay? These are small, subtle effects. They're real effects, but they're tiny. Okay? But there are these sex differences do exist in spatial ability, and they are driven by testosterone. We could also look at mating behavior and testosterone. You can take a male rat when he's born and castrate him. And then give him estrogen. It's not nice, but you know. When that male rat, when he gets older, meets up with a male, he'll exhibit a behavior called lordosis. In other words, he will present to the male. And I'm not going to get any further to what that means. I think you all figured that out. On the other hand, we could take a female rat, we could overectomize her, and give her shots of testosterone, and then when she meets another female, she will mount the female. Huh. Wow. So we got people throwing Nerf balls, rats having sex with each other. I saw all that on the internet, all in one thing once. That's got a name, by the way. We call that psychoneuroendocrinology. I just throw that in because I like saying it. It's the study of hormones, the nervous system, and behavior. In a lot of respects, it's the study of the autonomic nervous system and its effects on behavior. And it's a great word to toss into a conversation to make yourself sound smart. Oh, really? Yeah, psychoneuroendocrinology. Whoa, he's smart. He knows a big word. I guess the longest word I know. So I put it up there. Don't worry, I'm never going to ask you what it means, but maybe I will. Maybe I will. Basically, though, this is a big field, and there's actually a journal called Psychoneuroendocrinology. And there really is some fascinating stuff, because now that we're starting to understand more about how hormones control behavior, When I say control, very often what I mean is influence, okay? I'm not trying to say that I can make you mindless automatons by giving you shots of hormones, because if I could, I'd find the hormone that made everyone show up on time and hand their papers in on time. But what I'm saying is it certainly has a big effect, okay, of some sort. So pretty cool. All right, questions about that? Okay, let's move on. Yes? Psychoneuroendocrinology. Study of hormones, behavior, and the nervous system. So it's basically psychoneuroendocrinology is the study of the autonomic nervous system and its effects on behavior. It's a good way to roughly define it. Yeah. There's some really fascinating stuff. Some of the stuff is really, when I've looked at that journal, there are times, because like I said, there's a journal called Psychoneuroendocrinology. There are times when it's, to me, very often, the stuff's mind-boggling. I read it and go, Really? Glad I don't subscribe to this. On the other hand, there are times when there's some fascinating stuff, like the stuff about really sort of big behavior, things like spatial ability or things like aggression or mating behavior that, I mean, you can really sort of sink your teeth into and understand, and it's cool. It just depends. Okay, we got brain down. Let us speak of the behavior. Spelling it with a U the proper way. And you thought the definition of brain was amorphous, fuzzy, globby. Well, definition of behavior. Now, what's behavior? Whoa. That's not an easy one. I looked this up in a dictionary. I can't remember which one. Probably like dictionary.com. I do everything on the internet. The manner of conducting oneself. Your behavior. Don't think that's what we mean. That's like what your mom means by behave! Well, that was kind of evil for a mom.
Behave.
That was the first one was the evil mom if she's possessed by the devil. It's like Linda Blair. She was in Exorcist well before most of you were born. Okay. Here we go. Here's two. Anything that an organism does involving action, responses, and stimulation. Oh, I kind of like that. That's not bad. The response of an individual, group, or species to its environment. That's not so bad. And of course, we got behaviorally, yada, yada, yada. I wouldn't worry a lot about dictionary definitions, really, but, you know. That's actually, the second one's probably our better one here. This is more what we talk about when we talk about in psychology, right? That's response to a stimulus. Response to a stimulus. It seems like that we can crystallize from that. Oh, to its environment. So a stimulus is in the environment. Okay, good enough. The stimulus is in the environment. Don't worry about writing down the chiefly British adjective. Okay. Yeah, that's not bad. Yeah, you know, that's good enough. I think response to a stimulus, an environmental stimulus, we'll call that behavior. Yeah. Okay. I guess that'll do. Anybody see a potential problem there? Or does it seem okay? I don't know. Like, action response to stimulus. You can imagine pizza, and it's just around lunchtime, and you will begin to salivate. You can't help it, can you? It just happens. I can see a lot of you going, that's behavior. That's pretty simple behavior, salivation, but it's still behavior, I would say. Is the stimulus itself, is it external? No. Yeah, well, then I did tell you to imagine pizza, so maybe, you know, that's my fault. That's an external stimulus. Okay, a lot of you are hungry, I know. Don't worry, we'll be done in 10 minutes. Maybe even earlier if I feel like it. I'm such a rebel. Rebel without a clue. But if you're hungry and your gut is telling you you're hungry, like you feel that sort of hungry feeling, you do stuff, like you go and get something to eat. Is that an external stimulus? Well, by definition, your gut is in your gut. It's not external. Bloody hell. Wow. An organism. Oh, so plants behave? Yes, I know. There's those Venus flytraps and all that crap. But I mean, like, a daisy. A rose. Yeah, rose. Go the rose. By any other name, a rose would smell. I don't know. I can't. Shakespeare. Can't do it. I got one little bit of Shakespeare. It's a Lady Macbeth speech, of all things. Memorized in grade 12. Oh, yeah. Glams thou art and Cawdor and shalt be what thou art promised. Except that's a girl talking, so it's kind of weak, you know. Sounds great, but roses, though, what do? They open up with the sun. They go towards, these flowers go towards the sun. Would we call that behavior? I don't think most of us would. Are there courses on plant behavior? Not really. Animal behavior, that's what the cool kids take. So that's pretty weak. As a rule, dictionary definitions just suck. And that's something that we should keep in mind. I mean, really, as I said before, dictionaries don't help us a lot. It gets us in the right direction. So behavior is some observable reaction that has no obvious substance. Whoa, I kind of like that. In a way, it's kind of cool. It's an observable reaction, so you can see it. I'm walking around. But there's no substance. It's not like I'm making anything while I'm walking. Yeah, I kind of like that in a way. Yeah, that's another question, right? Yeah, because we're studying. We talk about brain and behavior, we're also going to study cognition and thinking. Would we call that behavior? typically we define psychology as the study of behavior and cognition, the scientific study of behavior and cognition, but would you call cognition behavior? Like when I'm sitting here thinking and I'm imagining, I'm trying to think about what I'm going to make for dinner. I actually am too. Chicken wings, do that. Anyway, is that behavior? Not by that definition, it's probably not, because it's not observable. It's not observable. If I ask you all to imagine last Christmas, let's pick something, or you know, whatever, what you had for breakfast, is that behavior? No. Is it controlled by your nervous system? Yeah. So, I guess naming the course neuroscience, behavior, and cognition would just be too long. So brain and behavior is okay. So, what does behavior actually mean then? I guess this is actually one I like. I think this is in the book. I think that's where I got this. Action of an organism having cause and function. And I guess probably I should say, I mean, the reason we use organism, I guess, is because we can certainly say that like an amoeba behaves, and it's not an animal. Though it doesn't have a nervous system either. It's a single-celled guy. But nonetheless, I think we call that behavior. Having cause and function. Okay, so let's go back to the moths, because I always go back to the moths. And some of you are sitting there, I can see the look on some of your faces, like, I've heard about the moths and bats, Dave. Will you just give it a rest? No, I won't. I love the moths and the bats. And some of you, you're laughing now, but you're going to hear about it over and over for the next 3 years of your life, and you're going to be going, oh, Christ, he's into the moths and the bats again. Anyway, the cause is the sound. The cause there is the sound, that's the ultrasound that the bat makes. The bat sound. Da, 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 da. Yeah. Couldn't help it, son. When I was a graduate student, a guy from, I think, Brown University came up to U of T and gave a talk about bats and bat behavior and their sonar, and it was so cool. And I actually thought about going and working with the guy for my postdoc, because partially the work was cool, but it would also just be great to say, first, he had a van. He used to go to catch wild bats, and it had a bat, like a Batman logo on the side, and that's kind of cool. And I wanted, just so I could just say to people, if they said to me, so what do you do for a living? I could look at them and say, I'm Batman. And then it's just, you know, I'm not going to kill you. I want you to tell your friends about me. You know, that kind of thing. So the sound is the cause. The function is the evasion. It's got cause and function. What does it accomplish? It's the evasion of the bat. The nice thing I like about this will include learned behavior, what we might want to call inherited stuff. Now, that's a false dichotomy, especially for a few of you that were sitting in my 3906 class a couple hours ago, realize it's a false dichotomy, and we will get there, don't worry. But when we talk about something that isn't really learned, let's put it that way. So it's going to include both those. That's the nice thing. The ability to eat. No one really learns how to eat. They just eat. Now, you learn manners and stuff like that. But you don't learn, like, you put food in your mouth and you chew it. I know people that have never learned that, though. But anyway, that's not learned, but it's still behavior. It's got a cause, hunger, and a function makes you less hungry, you know, nourishes you, right? So that's okay. Not all behavior has an obvious function. Okay, so the cause isn't always horribly easy, but we can usually reason it out or do simple experiments. Looking at the function, what something accomplishes, is not always the easiest thing to do. And it can have many different functions as well, behavior. I mean, a lot of causes, I guess, as well. All right. It's not always going to be obvious what the function of behavior is. Anybody have any questions? All right, let's wrap this up. I'll take this home and edit it. It'll be posted on the net within a couple hours. Thanks, everybody. See you next time on Friday, right? We have that weird time slot. At 8:30. Boo. Remember, on Friday, we never come in at 8. We start the 8:30 class at 8:40. Remember that, because I can't be here. Thanks, everyone. Yes. No. Yeah, there's no.
Is released under a Creative Commons copyright Sharealike 2.0 Canada 2006, some rights reserved. You are free to redistribute the information as long as you give attribution and do not use it for commercial purposes. The feed is feeds.feedburner.com /Dave_6. Email can be sent to Broadbeck, Brodbeck, at algomau.ca. All programs are recorded using a Griffin iTalk 2, a lapel microphone, and my iPod. They are then transposed onto my Intel-based MacBook Pro and mixed with GarageBand. For information on the music featured at the beginning and end of each episode, check the iTunes show notes or fire me off an email. Most of the stuff comes from a website called GarageBand. Thank you, everybody, and see you next time.